In the last class, we discussed how to derive the classical equation motion. Basically, our starting point is that we have a phase-space Lagrangian, which describe a quantum system. So the phase-space Lagrangian have this form. Which actually is a function of this wave function per psi and its derivative, basically. So then, in the classical physics, to obtain the classical equation motion, somehow we obtain this some kind of corresponding phase space Lagrangian. In some parameter space, a phase space. But this one is actually given by this. Formula is very similar to what we have above. Okay. So it looks like these two are the same thing. Why this is a quantum Schrödinger equation, this is a classical equation motion. And indeed, these two are very similar. In this case, this wave function is just any unit vector in the vector space. You know Hamiltonian, sorry, a quantum system is described by state in the vector space. And we have Hamiltonian act in the vector space. And the equation motion for the wave function actually can be written in terms of a Lagrangian form, where we have a unit vector in the vector space, so that's psi. And then you can using this unit vector in vector space as your phase space labeling, then you can form an equation motion moving inside this phase space. And to obtain this classical analog is that following. We no longer treat any unit vector in the vector space. We somehow select a subset of unit vector in the vector space, or some small collection. Then we try to consider the motion inside this small collection, this subset. So that's how we do it. So this kind of psi c is a subset of this unit vector. So this is like a variational state. A trial wave function. And the c is our trial parameter. Okay. But usually when we're using trial wave function, we just want to find a value of a parameter c to minimize Gwangsi energy, to obtain the good Gwangsi energy. That's how we use it. And here we use the trial wave function a different way. We say that our trial wave function is select very smartly so that the quantum motion at the low energy basically are described by different value of c. So basically, we say if you change the value of c, this wave function not only describes a ground state, but also describes some low-lying states. Then at the low energy, the motion of wave function basically are captured by this function labeled by c. And then we want to obtain classical picture. You say, what is a classical motion if you treat the c as a point in the phase space? And how this wave function move in the phase space? And then that's such kind of classical motion are described by this like a projection of this Lagrangian. We restrict this Lagrangian to some subspace. And that's how we get it. And so as one application for this, let's consider a quantum system, a kind of harmonic oscillator. Okay. So how do you choose this trial wave function? So our choice of trial wave function basically is we have c1 and c2 have two parameter. which is given by this alpha square root of alpha pi over a quarter and e to the I c 2x and e to minus 1 half alpha x minus c 1 squared. So this is our choice of a tri-wave function. And so usually one may choose this one, some Gaussian. You know, have a Gaussian wave packed centered at C1. So because this potential is some kind of like a anharmonic potential, some potential well, so some Gaussian wave function would be very nice. That describes ground states. Okay. So this is the most natural thing to do. You want to do this. Okay. But there's a problem if you do this. Because if you do this, there's only one parameter. Yes? C2. Oh, yes. Maybe I should have put that. Only up and down index. Okay. So, but this one have only one parameter. You know, usually in the phase space Lagrangian, we need two parameters. You know, one is coordinate and one is momentum. So one parameter is kind of inconvenient. But certainly you may insist on using one parameter to see what you get from here. I don't know, I didn't try, but you may get something very strange. Okay. And so we need another parameter. But the other parameter should be kind of like a dual or canonical conjugate of the first parameter. And in this case, it's kind of obvious. Because of the first parameter basically describes the center mass of a wave packet, the canonical conjugate of a location should be momentum. So this is why we choose the second parameter as a momentum, a wave vector. And so there's some kind of duality relation between these two parameters. And so this in this case is obvious. But in some other not so obvious case, one can follow similar way of thinking. You know, there's one parameter, another parameter is better to be dual. The reason is following. We not only want to obtain the ground state energy, we also want to see the motion of the parameter. To really capture the motion, we need something to shift it, to boost it. And the boost for the position is the momentum. The momentum, like a translation to the position, we translate. And so in general, we need this pair. You don't have to be exact. You know, if it's off a little bit, it's fine. But you better have something like that. Okay. Okay. So this is basically why we choose this parameter. Yes?
So projecting back to this is assuming your wave function will stay as a sum of a bunch of Gaussians whose width would stay the same.
Very good point. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that's one of them you can choose as a project. So it's very nice to say alpha can have a time dependent. We can choose alpha as dynamic variable. So wave pattern can breathe. And now this challenge, what is a dual or conjugate for the alpha? It's a little challenging. I don't know, I haven't solved all of it, but so this would be something quite interesting to see. What is the proper conjugate of alpha? And I don't know. I can think about it. And then you do something better. You have an alpha and a beta. You have four parameters. You have not only have a motion of center mass, you have motion for breadth of a wave packet. And you may get a better result. Yeah. So this is I don't know. Yeah, this is a we'll see whether this would help or not. But anyway. So this is a but once you set up this, then everything else is mathematics. Just plug in, you get results. Yeah. So the most difficult thing is to have some intuition, some idea, how to set things up, how to choose properly these two parameter. Okay. So let's just once we set it up, so let's just quickly do the math. And so formally this let me just start from here. So if I do the calculation here, this one can be written as a following, as a AI, which is a function of KC, maybe it's called J and KC I dot, and some average Hamiltonian is function of KC I. So this H bar is just this average, is a function of KC. So let me explain this a little bit. And this AI, actually, you can see this time derivative is goes through this KC, only KC depend on time. So therefore, this AI is really given by I times, there's some KC dependence, but DD KC, partial KC. AI is a vector in the KC space, so it's just the overlap of wave function with the derivative respect to KC, just some kind of overlap. Okay, and once you know this derivative respect to KC, then derivative respect to time just basically given by derivative of respect to KC times the KC dot. That's the kind of chain rule. Okay, so this is a phase-based Lagrangian. So therefore, you can see to derive phase-based Lagrangian, it's very important to calculate this term, the derivative respect to KC, and with overlap. Okay. And this term have a interesting a meaning. It's actually a geometrical phase, also called the Barrett's phase. So this term is related to the geometric phase. So therefore, the phase-based Lagrangian have two terms. One term is very simple, just average energy, Hamiltonian. But the first term is what we call the, you know, px dot term. The px dot term in this case actually is a Barrett's phase term or geometric phase term, have this interpretation. And this is the general structure of phase-based Lagrangian. This one will have a geometric phase term and a Hamiltonian term. They together give us this phase-based Lagrangian. Why we call this a geometrical phase term? And so let's consider the following just overlap of this KC plus, no, just KC I and the KC I plus some kind of delta KC. Let's consider this overlap. This overlap just basically equal to 1 if delta KC equal to 0. If delta KC not equal to 0, this term basically is a pure phase term. It's a pure phase term. Why is pure phase term? Okay, so because both wave functions are normalized, okay, and so it's like two vectors. They differ by a little bit. They differ by a little bit. When we do the overlap, you know, the absolute value overlap is like this projection of this vector to this. But this change of length if this is delta, this change of length will be delta squared. So when you do the overlap, the change of the absolute value only changed by delta squared term, which is high order, so we ignore. We only keep linear order term. So if you keep only linear order term, the only thing that can change is a phase. So this is a e to the I delta phi. This is a phase. And this is the proper definition of a geometrical phase. That is, when you have a family of wave vector, you can do this overlap, consecutive overlap. And so you want to compare two states, two nearby states. But if the two states are very close, the only difference is the Barrett phase term. And then you can do the comparison, etc. Okay. So I will not go into Barrett phase term too much. Okay, so this is Barrett phase term. But from this point of view, you can see that if you expand this, this will be as a 1 plus I delta phi. Then clearly from this, you can see that this delta phi is equal to, let me put a minus sign here. So that would be, so I can put I here. So delta phi will have this form. And the written in what we use in terms of A will be like AI plus delta I. So that's why I say this AI describe a geometrical phase. Because if you multiply AI by a small change of delta plus CI, then this one is a phase of comparing two nearby states or coherent states. We call this a coherent state. So therefore, and this is very, I feel very good to realize this. The first term in the phase space, Lagrangian, actually have a, in quantum mechanics, it's kind of like a Barrett phase term. And the second term is just a total energy. So this Barrett phase term plus total energy capture the dynamics of the quantum system. So this is a very appealing. Yeah. And so for those who know some mathematics called the symplectic structure, then I just want to make comment that the phase space is really some kind of symplectic manifold with symplectic structure. And the first, this one determines some kind of function in this symplectic manifold. And this Barrett phase term define the symplectic structure. Once you have a symplectic structure and its function, you determine the phase space equation motion. So there's some mathematical way to say the same thing. Okay. So with this comment, so let's just plug in. Then if you plug in, using this plug-in, we find this A1 equal to 0 and A2 equal to minus C1. And this is easy to see. A1 means that we make a derivative respect to C1. If you do that, we'll bring down a factor x minus C1 factor. Then you need to do the integration. You have a Gaussian on one side, x minus C1, and another Gaussian on the other side. When you do the overlap. But now you have this extra factor. And because of this Gaussian wave function even is symmetric about C1, now you have some odd function about C1, so this integration gets equal to 0. So that's why we have nothing here. And but however, when you, for the A2 is derivative respect to C2, and then you bring down an x, you just bring down an x when you respect C2, bring down x. So you have something like you have some x here. Then you do this. You have psi and psi dagger, psi star on both sides. You do this average. But this space is the average of x. And this wave packet is centered at C1. So its average position is C1. So this average of x is C1. So that's why you get this. can see one, but with a minus sign. So there are some sign. Okay. And H bar will be it's easy to understand. It's just some average energy. It's messy. It's because we have a quartic term. It's pretty messy to compute. So let's just write down the answer. So it's just a 1/2 C2 squared plus 3 alpha plus 2 alpha squared V 4 alpha squared C1 squared plus 1/4 C1 to the 4th power plus 3 plus 4 alpha cubed. That's it. Okay. So this is result. So let's just understand what this result tell us. Okay. This term actually is like variational energy. And when the C certainly actually the whole thing is variational energy. Okay. And we can see that this variational energy is minimized if both C1 and C2 equal to zero. Because the contribution from C1 and C2 are all positive. If C1 and C2 equal to zero, this one will be minimized. But however, it's also dependent on alpha. So we can choose a proper value of alpha to minimize this wave function further. So that means there's some particular alpha which really minimizes energy. So that wave packet have a lowest energy. Actually, we want to choose that alpha. So alpha is not arbitrary parameter. We want to choose alpha which minimizes this term. So that determines the size of wave packet. Then C1 and C2 just describe how this wave packet move around. Okay. How they move around, if you look at the energy, then you have a, say, remember C2 is like a momentum. C1 is like a coordinate. But it's not just what we say. It's really from this structure. Because A1 equal to 0, A2 equal to minus C1. So actually, this we have a term which is minus C1 to C2 dot. We have this term. And this term is equal to C2 to C1 dot plus or minus a total derivative of C1 times C2. And this is more standard form. This is like X dot and C2 like a P. So this is a P X dot term. So actually, you can read it off. So if I rewrite this a little bit, we see that this Bowers phase term have this C2 times C1 dot. That means we can interpret C1 as coordinate, and C2 will be its canonical momentum. Now, because this Bowers phase term has this standard form, P times X dot. So this is the reason why we say C2 is a momentum, C1 is a coordinate. But certainly, you can do this as well. You say C2 is coordinate, C1 minus C1 is a canonical momentum. It's okay, that's equally okay. But then interpretation will be a little bit different. So let's using the second interpretation. Okay. So then if you second interpretation, this term is very simple. This is like a P square term. That's a kinetic energy, which is actually reproduce this term. Yes?
Is there a reason that you need to identify the P's and X's effectively beforehand? Because doesn't that formula give you a sort of canonical way to calculate the canonical formula?
Exactly, yeah.
So you could have realized it.
Yeah, you're totally right. Even this bar is very messy. It could be very messy. You know, A1, A2 can be arbitrary function of C. Then you can get a very messy canonical momentum. And then write this in terms of X and the P. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you're totally right. And here you see, beyond here we have very simple things. So this term is kinetic energy, just like this. And this term is a potential energy, kind of like this, not exactly. And you can easily see the difference. First, in this case, you can see when v equals to 0, the spring tension will be 0. We have a pure, you know, x to the fourth term. Not here. When the v equals to 0, even when v equals to 0, we still have a 3 alpha over 4 alpha squared. Alpha is not equal to infinite or 0. So even when v equals to 0, we still have a finite spring constant. So what that means, that means falling. When v is 0, very small, this will describe oscillator which almost have a zero frequency, because the potential at the bottom very flat. The frequency of oscillation is very small, almost 0. But this is not right picture in the quantum. If you do quantum physics properly, the wave packet have a finite size. Because wave packet have finite size, it's filled this quadratic potential further. And it's indeed do not want to move around. So therefore, actually, the effective spring constant is finite. And that's quantum effect. Because in the classical physics, it's like a wave function, it's really delta function. So you only see this flat part. So certainly that's the frequency will be 0. But because quantum fluctuation, the wave packet is big. And then you see some effective spring constant. So this is that effect. And so therefore, so once you have this, this became a standard problem. You know, it's really describe a modified harmonic oscillator. The spring constant is renormalized from the V to some combination like this. Yeah. So certainly, if V is very, very big, and the alpha term doesn't matter. So in large V limit, you can see this term approaches this term. So this is this give you some idea, you know, how to derive the some kind of effective classical motion from a quantum system, and then we find the effective classical motion is similar to this what we expected, but with some kind of renormalization, and this correction is due to the quantum fluctuation. Okay. So this is just a very simple example. Yes.
How do you separate the constant term?
Oh, constant term is just some shift of energy. In class, if you're only interested in the motion, this doesn't matter. But however, if you're interested in the total energy of the system, this matters. And in particular, we can see that the ground state energy is a okay, so ground state energy is this constant term basically, which already include the zero point motion contribution. However, knowing constant term and knowing this spring constant, we even know the first excited energy. Usually, it's hard to calculate because this is an harmonic oscillator. To calculate ground state or excited state, we had to diagonalize big matrix. And here we didn't do that. We say the ground state is this one. And the first excited is this one plus some frequency determined by this spring constant. You know, there's h bar omega. So actually, we get an explicit expression for the first excited states. Basically, it's something like this. Okay. But certainly, this is approximate. But if a lecture notes, you can see that the numerical value is very close to exact results. So this is a pretty good way to calculate the first excited state. And you can also try the second or third excited state. But when you get higher energy, things became less accurate. So this is this demonstrates, you know, how this was used. And Okay, so this with this kind of example, so let's consider what we really want to do. So remember, what we want to do is that we have some band. We have some kind of hopping Hamiltonian in the describing tight binding model. Okay, from this hopping Hamiltonian, and we obtain some kind of a dispersion relation. So this is just a one band model, and we'll consider multi band later. So where this Tn actually is equal to T, let me see which way it is goes. I plus N I. Because hopping only depends on its distance. So Tn is just how long it hop. Okay. So once you know there's a hopping Tn doing its Fourier transmission, you get this dispersion relation, the energy level spectrum. So this is what we get in the first class. Okay. And so we want to really derive its motion. And because when you have arbitrary dispersion relation, we don't have a notion of a mass. Okay. So we cannot use Newton's law, F equal to ma. So we have some trouble to see how to understand the motion of a particle inside this periodic potential. And but now we can using this method, we can do it. And the key point again is to using this to design a wave packet. So this is very similar. We can design a wave packet. So a wave packet definition is this. Some kind of normalization constant. Over 2 Kc squared. Then this Kc is like a size wave packet. Then e to the I, k dot, these two I are different, and this I space is like. Okay. So what we do is here is following. We just include this Gaussian factor. Remember, if you don't have this Gaussian factor, this is just plane wave. And this plane wave is eigenstate of this Hamiltonian, whose eigenvector, eigenvalue is epsilon k. Okay. But the plane wave have no center mass location. It's there's no position. So what you do is that we multiply a Gaussian factor to this plane wave. So this plane wave is a non-zero only near x, and the decay away, you know, with at the length scale Kc. Kc is the size of wave packet. So another way to look at this wave packet is that this wave packet is superposition plane wave with momentum near k. The spread of momentum delta k is of order 1 over Kc. It's a 1 over size of wave packet. Yeah. So that's kind of a picture of this wave packet. And this k and x, it became our variational parameter, our parameter for the coherent states. And then we want to, then using this wave packet, to plug in there to see what is the phase space Lagrangian and what is the motion. And that's it. So that's how we understand the motion. So basically, we construct wave packet in the vector space, and we say how the wave packet move around. And usually, you will say that the wave packet will spread as it move around. So this Kc will become bigger and bigger. And but however, in this case, obviously we ignore the spreading of Kc. We kind of assume the wave packet move around without changing the shape. And so that is a, that's kind of approximation we did here. Okay. So once we have this, then we can just do the math. So the most important thing is to construct some kind of physical coherent states. So from there, we can reveal the classical motion. And before I really do the math, I want to generalize this a little bit to include a potential term. So this I really have a vector in it. So this term is ith diagonal. So the coefficient tell us at this I side, I have energy plus a phi. Usually, I assume, you know, before I assume every side have same energy zero. So now I assume different side may have a different starting energy. And then we have hopping between different sides. So we add some potential energy term on for each side. Okay. So then we can, so we can just do the same calculation, try to plug in. So this looks like a very hard calculation, but actually it's a very simple calculation. So let me just write it. So let's do this calculation first. When I write down this is equal to x times k dot. You see, this is too quick. I mean, why is it so simple? This is pretty messy here. So actually, this is pretty simple. You can really see that. The reason is following. When you do this derivative respect to t, you can see the t is contained in the k and x. So therefore, this term contains a derivative respect to k and a derivative respect to x. So when you have a derivative respect to k, then derivative respect to k will bring down I. That's the location I here. Bring that down. And then when you consider this overlap, then you essentially get something like I, but then you have the wave function, you know, e to the minus 1/2 c square, you know, I minus x square. And then there's another part, a Gaussian on the side. I minus x square. So this is like Psi, this is like Psi star. And you have something in between I. Take its average. The same thing, it's this wave pack centered at x. So average of I just gave you x. And certainly, this is coming from derivative respect to k. So then we have in the chain rule, so we have x and k dot. So that's why I have something like that. And but there's another term with derivative respect to x. When you have a derivative respect to x, then you bring down something like I minus x. And then there's something like I minus x here. You do the average integration over I. Again, this wave pack is centered at x. And this one is odd, you know, about x. So this average is equal to 0 in this case. So that's why we don't have this, we don't have the other term. You know, there should be have something with x dot. But this term is 0. So we don't have that. OK, so that's it. And then we have a term kx. This is a hopping Hamiltonian. See, okay. Oh, this is hard. This is very difficult to calculate. Because hopping Hamiltonian is this part. So this part is a H hop. Then you have this messy wave function and want to calculate this h-hop. That certainly is difficult. But however, here we make approximation. We say Kasi is pretty big. You know, if Kasi is infinite, this is a plane wave. Then this average is very easy to do. This is just an epsilon k. If Kasi is infinite, this is an eigenstate. So that's it. But Kasi is not infinite. Kasi is finite. If Kasi is finite, that means the k has some uncertainty here. So there's some error. But the error will be something like partial epsilon partial k times delta k. Something of that order, you know. But delta k is of order 1 over Kasi. Okay. So basically, we say that, so let's consider we have this kind of spectrum. Epsilon k is like this. If 1 over Kc is a delta k, it's a small, so that, you know, we can ignore this kind of change. So there's some ambiguity, some approximate. If we say, oh, in this place, this roughly just epsilon k, it's with some small errors. And so this is what we do. We say, OK, we say it's approximately it's epsilon k. There's no such term. OK, that's pretty simple. And then we have this the potential term. So let's call this phi term. So we have we make life harder, so we add a potential term. So what is this? You say, oh, this is must be very difficult because we have some average of this potential using Gaussian wave packet, and the Kasi is very big, so we average over a large area. And here we make another approximation. We say this potential is a smooth, very, very smooth. Means even smoother at the scale of Kasi. Kasi is very big. But we say at the scale of Kasi, the potential almost don't change. So it's very, very smooth. And so in that limit, the potential almost constant term in the region wave packet. So this average just equal to this constant. It's just equal to phi, which it may depend on the x, actually. So that's it. So from here we immediately see that the phase space Lagrangian is just collecting all those terms, it became L equal to K plus X dot minus epsilon K and x. And certainly here I kind of ignore this total derivative term x dot k, because this term is x times k dot. I kind of convert this into k times x dot, but differ by some total time derivative term, which we kind of throw away. Okay, so this is a phase space Lagrangian, which control the motion of this wave packet. Okay, so now we have a classical picture. The classical picture, then the equation motion from this will be like k dot equal to minus partial phi partial x and x dot equal to partial epsilon partial k. So this is and this equation is very familiar because k is kind of like a momentum. So momentum, time derivative momentum equal to force. Partial phi partial x is a force. Okay. You know, actually I skip here. Actually you can derive from here to here. I didn't do it, but it's straightforward because plug in this Lagrangian equation, you can get this result. So I won't do that. And this term actually is interesting. This term is generalization of a momentum velocity relation. In Newton's equation, we should have something like x dot equal to p over m. You know, Newton particle have a mass m. So p over m is a velocity. So we should have something like this. Oh, in our notation should be the k over m because k is p. But indeed, if it's epsilon equal to 1/2 m k squared, so if this epsilon have this kind of a standard dispersion relation, this equation will become the standard one, velocity equal to p over m. But this relation is generalized. It became velocity equal to derivative of a partial epsilon partial k. It's still function of k, but it's a complicated function of k. No longer, it's not like a velocity proportional momentum. It's a velocity, it's a function of momentum, but it can be a complicated function. And that's it. With this generalization, we get these results. Okay. Yes.
So what is the length scale we should compare to determine?
So the thing is that so there's a several things. Say this cause C should be much bigger than the lattice constant. That's a separation between two lattice points. And then the cause C should be much smaller than L phi, let's call this. The L phi is the length scale where phi have some significant change. So we say phi is very, very smooth. You know, at a large scale, C, phi almost constant. So in this limit, this would work. Otherwise, things would be complicated. Otherwise, we are using some average phi, using this Gaussian average phi here as effective potential. OK. So this is okay, this is a motion. And this motion actually is very interesting. Let's just describe one particular solution. Suppose in one dimension, remember in one dimension tight bonding model, we have some kind of dispersion relation like this. So this is a epsilon k. This is a minus pi to pi. Okay. Yes.
So the characteristic length here is much bigger than the lattice spacing.
Yes.
But also much smaller than the length scale of the potential.
Yes.
But isn't the
length scale potential actually this? The potential is what is length scale potential? Suppose we suppose potential like this. We say okay, the potential have a significant change during this length scale. So that's all I'll find. No, not that. It's just that's how they vary in space. It's almost constant on every side, but it's a vary over large scale. Then the lattice spacing is like this. So this is the lattice spacing, and our wave packet is this size. So that's how the scale was separated, and only in this case this kind of description works. Otherwise, the distribution is a bad approximation. Yes?
So do we break the translation symmetry by doing
this? Oh, yeah, we break translation symmetry. When you have a potential, we break translation symmetry. So actually, that's why we want to include this first term. You know, if I don't include the phi, then the k dot will be constant. So momentum will be conserved. But when you break translation invariance, you add the phi, then the k dot is not equal to zero. Momentum is not conserved.
We don't expect there to be position dependent potential.
And the thing is, we have perfect crystal phi is constant, so we don't need that. But then the particle inside this perfect crystal don't move. And we want to describe the motion, we want to push them to move around. And we including phi, this phi is our push, you know, try to push them around. They're like an electric field. So we can see how we actually I'm going to describe how we push things around. Suppose we have a constant electric field. When you have a constant electric field, this potential is like a linear at in some region. Okay. So how particle move under constant influence electric field? Also, it's very easy, very simple. When you push the particle continuously, the particle would keep accelerating. The velocity getting higher and higher and higher indefinitely. Well, that's not true for this case. Because as you push this particle, its momentum increase linearly in time and increase indefinitely with time. So the momentum would go from here, the next moment to here, to here, to here, to here. You know, the momentum just go. But the point is that when the momentum reach the pi and the minus pi is the same thing. So this momentum live on a circle. So it's kind of go back. So momentum kind of then go back to pi and the minus pi is the same. So it kind of jump to here. This is like uncollapse process, we say. Then it's then still increase. So momentum just keep increasing like this. It's a circle, so you can do that over and over again. But what is the velocity? Velocity is the slope of dispersion relation. That's what they tell us. This is the key. The velocity is a slope of a dispersion relation. So here, velocity equals zero. So as function of time, initially, velocity equals zero. Then as you push it, velocity would increase. And increase, when you reach to here, the velocity reaches maximum, actually. When you push it further, something funny happens. The slope starts to decrease, so velocity getting smaller. And then reach zero. Actually, this should be linearly grow. And reach zero, when you reach the zone boundary. And we're still pushing further. But then we do too much a good thing. The velocities go in opposite direction against our push. And then back to zero from a full circle. So basically, as you push electron in the lattice, the velocity sometimes go forward, sometimes go backward, sometimes go forward, sometimes go back. It oscillates. So we generate oscillating currents. And so that is what the equation will tell us. And certainly this is not what happened in the material. And so that's something very puzzling. But anyway, this is the truth, actually. So if you really do this, this could happen, but not in the real material. In the real material, there's another effect, so that this don't happen. So so the other effect is a friction. So here I describe the motion of a particle without friction. Indeed, without friction, if you don't have a friction, then when you try to apply electric field to the crystal, the electron in the crystal would oscillate. And usually the friction is pretty big, electric field is pretty small. So we can hardly create a situation where electric field dominates effect of friction. So the effect we observe in the traditional solid is a friction dominated. So it's different from what you describe here. But however, when you create some very perfect solid with a very little friction, apply very strong electric field, you can indeed observe this oscillation currents. Yeah. So this is so this kind of strange motion of a particle inside a solid. So any question here? Yes. It's really just how k, you know, the time scale for k to increase from minus pi to pi. That's one period. And so it depends on this, but this depends on electric field. They do not depend on system size. Yeah. And here I want to say the following. In this picture, I only consider one particle in the band, or maybe a few particles in the band. You know, there are situations, I think next week you'll hear that we can fill the band, you know, that's different situation. And when you fill the band, Okay, maybe let me just mention this a little bit because we are going to discuss it later. So what we describe here, we have just a few particles near the band bottom. And then we push it, this particle just moving around. You know, because k keep increasing, this particle just move in a band and go back just like this. But remember, this energy band are just those energy levels. Those are just energy levels. When you have many fermions, the two fermions cannot, let's consider spinless fermion just for simplicity. The two fermions cannot occupy same energy level. So when you have two fermions, we have to be one here, another one must be here. When you have many fermions, then you may occupy more levels. Remember, number of level, the number of level equal to n. N is the number of sites that we did the counting. The number of level in this band is equal to number of sites. However, if a number of electron equal to number of sites, so if you have one electron per site, then every level is a field. Okay. In that case, when you apply electric field, they push it. Every electron would move in the same rate. A k just move around. But however, no matter how they move, you always get the same state back. The state is every level is filled. You know, so therefore, this pushing a changing k don't do anything. Don't generate any current in particular, because a current is an average velocity. When you fill the band, average velocity equals zero. When you're shifting k, average velocity still equal to zero. This is different from partially filled band. When you have partially filled band, we'll push it. This k would shift from here to here. You know, originally, this velocity is very small. Now, velocity is very big. But when we have filled band, when you try to move in k around, you still have a filled band. Nothing changes. You still have zero velocity. So the partially filled band is a metal. Filled band is an insulator. So that's why we have sometimes we have metal, sometimes we have an insulator. Once we have a filled band, we have an insulator. If the band is not totally filled, we have a metal. And this can be seen from here. So that's kind of explain the metal and insulator. So other questions? Yes. Yeah, k live on a ring, so that's key. The k live on a ring. Okay, lattice is also a ring, yes. Exactly. Yeah. K is like an average momentum. Now here the momentum, the velocity is different. It's quite different. You know, in the Newton's case, momentum velocity just differ by a constant, m. And here, they can be quite different.
When you say one particle, you mean one of these Gaussian packets corresponds to one electron.
Yeah, exactly. I'm thinking of the, yeah, when I say one particle, I'm really thinking of the, just a one electron in the whole system. But when you have a few electrons, they don't interfere. So I can, using one electron picture, then just add their effect. But when you have many, many electrons, the things became a little more complicated. They may interfere because the Pauli principle may take effect. And then we may have a picture fill the band. Then the picture is different. Then we get the insulator.
You expanded about the minimum of that dispersion relation. I mean, if you keep piling these things, the energy will not be no longer. So,
that's why we don't see this effect very easily. Because when you push it, the energy of electron became very high. They are very unhappy to stay there. They want to find a way to lose their energy coming back to here. That is the friction. So the friction is trying to move things back to the minimum. and the pushing try to push it over this hill. If you push really hard, and the electron quickly get to the top before it's losing its energy, you can push it over the top, then you get oscillation. That's really the picture. But usually in the material, electron loses energy very efficiently. They can quick, when you push a little bit away from minimal, it's quickly go back to minimal. And you push them away, you go back to minimal. So this competition make this wave pack slightly deviated from the bottom. So that you get currents, but constant current, not oscillating currents. But if you really push really, really hard, you can go over the top, then you get oscillating currents. So that is a that's a cool part of this this motion in the band. But usually it's very hard to reach that limit where you can push over the top. Yeah. Okay. So far we describe the motion electron in the band. And actually this picture is pretty similar to Newton's picture. Yeah. And it's just this the velocity as a function momentum is changed from velocity is a proportional momentum to velocity can be an arbitrary function of a momentum. So this is generalization. In the next, I want to say this is not enough. In a single band picture, yes, this is okay. This is we derive this. But actually, when you have a multi-band, we have a several, like in graphene, there's another effect which is overlooked here. So this equation is not quite correct. There's some missing terms. And this missing term will appear in multi-band picture, like graphene you studied. So the Newton's equation get further modified and in the band. So in next we're going to study this this further modification of a Newton's equation. Yeah. So this may make one wonder, you know. Newton's equation not just equation, it's a law, you know. And then we say it's not true in a semiconductor. Then we wonder why it's true in the vacuum, why it's true in the nature. You know, maybe our nature is one big semiconductor. And we might see these additional corrections. And you may see, we don't see, yeah. So actually we do see this correction. This correction had been discussed before. Because in a relativistic quantum mechanics, the energy is not square. Its energy is a is something like mc squared plus c squared p squared. I think something like that. Yes. So this is a dispersion relation for energy for the relativistic particle. So therefore this kind of correction had been already observed. But there's yet another correction, and so let's discuss the other correction. So to understand the other correction, another effect. So we need to go to multiband picture. So when you have a multiband, so let's just review a little bit. So what we have in the multiband. The Hopping Hamiltonian just equal to this Tij AB, and where we're using I and A to label a site, and Gib to label a site, because each unit cell may have several sites. And then we construct some kind of matrix we call the MK with a index is AB. And this matrix basically is a Fourier transmission of this hopping matrix, TAB. N is a distance hop. And then we do this Fourier transmission. And let me see. Yeah, e to the minus n dot k. N is a vector. So all these are vectors. OK. So this is a. So this is a matrix. Once you know this matrix, we find that the Hamiltonian can be written in the K basis. this k basis is a ka basis is a sum over e to the I k j j a sum over j. So we go to the k basis. Using the k basis, so there's one over square root of n here. Okay. In the k basis, then the Hamiltonian became simpler. It became with sum over k, and this this mk ab yeah okay so in the k basis it's almost like hopping Hamiltonian. You know, this Hamiltonian means JB can hop to IA, can hop around. If you change your basis, it's also like hopping. KB can hop to KA with the hopping matrix amplitude is just given by this MK, which is a Fourier transformation for T. And the simplification we get is that K no longer changes. K is fixed. So we will have hopping between A and A and B index. So if each union cell have only two sites, so this one just hop between two sites or two states. So it's 2x2 matrix. So therefore, we can diagonalize this Hamiltonian by diagonalize this 2x2 matrix or 3x3 matrix if there are three sites per union cell. And that's become a much simpler problem. Okay. And if you do that, we find that the eigenstates, so this is a basis, but the eigenstates of this 2x2 Hamiltonian or the Hamiltonian is labeled by K and alpha, which is given by given by this kind of plane wave. E to the I K J. And we have this a wave function, this a phi alpha K. And we sum over J and A. Sorry, this is a alpha. This is a wave function have a component. Yes. And the notation is that this mk ab, when you multiply this psi alpha k with it's a b component, you become epsilon alpha k psi alpha with a component. I'm sorry about this. All this messy mess. And basically, so let me write this in a more compact form. So this just column vector labeled by this index b, and this is a matrix. So using matrix notation, just this m times this column vector, and which gave us another same column vector back is eigenstates. But with the coefficient epsilon. Yeah. And we can do that for every point of a k. You know, k is just some label. For every k, we just have matrix. Then for every k, we can have a column vector. They can diagonalize the matrix. We get this. But because this matrix is some kind of like a 2x2, 3x3 matrix, so it have several eigenvalues and have several eigenvectors. So this alpha just label this a different eigenvalue and eigenvector. Okay, so therefore the band structure is we have several band, you know, this band and that band and etc. So this may be like alpha equal to 1, this alpha equal to 2, you know, so this would be epsilon 1, epsilon 2k, this is like epsilon 1k. So then for every choice of k, we have this eigenvalue here, eigenvalue here, these two eigenvalue for every fixed k is determined by this particular matrix at that k. And at each point, we also have the eigenvector. For this band, we have one eigenvector. This band has another eigenvector, which is a wave function. So that's kind of picture of multiband. Okay. Then something new happens, is falling. You can see each Actually, each point not only have an energy eigenvalue, but also have some kind of eigenvector. So let's use this arrow to describe the eigenvector. So it has some eigenvectors, which is given by this psi k. This column vector is eigenvector. Then something interesting happens, because as you shift the k around, because when you push it, the k will move around. And here, the eigenvector and that eigenvector may not be parallel. It may twist by the angle. And here, the eigenvector may be here. The eigenvector may twist around. This don't happen in a single band picture. In a single band picture, the whole vector space is one-dimensional. We have eigenvectors, all eigenvectors always in the same direction. They cannot move around. But when we have multi-band, this eigenvector can have k dependence. They may move around. And this, the fact that this eigenvector may move around, then this may give you additional effect. And this effect causes a further correction to the Newton's equation. The Newton's law gets further modified because this eigenvector in the band can twisting around as you move around in the k space. Okay. And so basically, in the following, we'll just study this effect of twisting this eigenvector around. And this is another Barry's phase effect. Because remember, the Barry's phase is that we try to compare to eigenvector, nearby eigenvector, what the overlap. And we may give a Barry phase. If this eigenvector all parallel, then it's just overlap all equal to 1. So there's no effect. But when eigenvector kind of twisting around, you have to have some kind of Barry's phase. And this Barry's phase would modify the Newton's law. So causing additional modification of Newton's law. And then we have a setup to really study this effect of a Barry's phase. So how Newton's law get modified when you have this additional, when you have this additional effect. And so there's some mass. So let's go through some mass. Okay. Yes.
What's the interpretation of this vector, the psi alpha, the eigenvector of the m, which we got from the original Hamiltonian? Do the components correspond to probability of the as opposed to the other?
Very good. So let me. This is very important. So let's describe this again. So how we construct the band structure? How we get the picture of the band? We just pick a k. Okay. When you pick a k, at this particular k, you know, the k is fixed. Only this a and b get mixed together. And how they mix together is controlled by this m. OK. So you know, diagonalize this m matrix to obtain eigenstates. OK, for that particular k. And this m gave us several eigenvalues. Then we get one eigenvalue here, another eigenvalue here. So we get a spectrum at this particular k. But I also gave us eigenvectors. So therefore, for this spectrum, for this eigenvalue, we get one eigenvector, which is described by this psi alpha. And here we get another eigenvector described. So this is like a eigenvector is a psi 1. This is like a psi 2. You know, alpha labeled the band. But what is the meaning of this different component? Remember, this psi alpha, this A index actually is index for the site in the unit cell. But alpha index is an index for the band, which band? So let's say alpha equal to 1. If alpha equal to 1, this psi 1, this psi alpha equal to 1, have this psi, again, alpha equal to 1, alpha equal to 1. But A can be equal to 1, or A can be equal to 2. They have two components, for example. We have a two side per unit cell. So therefore, these two components of a psi actually is one for a equal to 1, another for a equal to 2. That means that when you have this particular plane wave on this particular band, you ask, what kind of weight, what is amplitude of this weight in the first side or second side in the unit cell? And these two components just describe the amplitude of this plane wave in each atom in the unit cell. For example, if this happened to be 0, that means this plane wave is very special. This plane wave only live in the second side union cell. They don't live in the first side union cell. So you can see how the plane wave are distributed in the two sides within union cell. And this distribution is k-dependent. Sometimes, say here, maybe they distribute equally. And here, maybe the opposite. You know, they can be, they have different distribution. So it is because the distribution of a wave function in different side of union cell can vary as you're changing k. That may cause some additional effect of Newton's law. So basically, even this like internal structure of this particle. This internal structure twisting around as the momentum moving around. That is a. So actually, in one of the homework problems, we studied this using in the continuum. We consider a particle with a spin. And Hamiltonian have a term that try to lock spin and momentum together. So spin always parallel to momentum. Then we have a similar effect. When momentum, when you're using force to push momentum around, the spin actually twisting around. And you compare a state with different spin orientations, that gives you actual various phase time. Yeah. And so in general, in a semiconductor, when electron moving inside in the crystal, this kind of internal structure twisting around as momentum change is generically happening. It happens. So then you may have generically you have some additional effect.
Degree of freedom in my classical description picture, and then try to.
It's not quite a new degree of freedom. It's a because it's locked. It's a frozen. You can see, for every k, this internal degree of freedom is a fixed. So it's not freedom, but it's something there. As k moves, this freedom has to follow. It became a degree of freedom. We will consider two bands together. When you jump from, if you fix k, you jump from this band to that band, you really redistribute among this site in a unit cell. So that this new degree of freedom would be liberated. But if you restrict yourself in a single band, this new degree of freedom is a slave of k. Usually, if a slave have should have no effect. It just don't do anything. It just follow the k. But this Barrier's phase term tell us this even though it's a slave, it contributes a Barrier's phase, and modify the phase space Lagrangian, so it have dynamical effect actually. So that's why it's missed for so many years, and you know people usually think, oh, we have degree phase is frozen along the k, it's a slave of k, so we can drop it. We don't think about it, and then using this picture. It's very tempting just to use that picture. It turns out that's not quite right. There's additional effect. Yeah. So it's a very good question. Yeah. Okay. So let's do it. And so here the wave packet is this. I have to fix a band index, meaning that I will consider a particular band. Like a first band, a second band. Let's consider a particular band. And then this wave function is this particle. It's very much like what we did before. And but here's the actual term, alpha A. Okay. So basically, without this, we get a plane wave. Okay, that's eigenstate. But here we have multiband. To tell its eigenstate, we have to say how each site enter. What is amplitude on each side? You know. So this a phi function. This alpha, remember alpha is fixed. So this amplitude as a function of a tell us. For each site, what is amplitude? We are choosing this amplitude properly. we get eigenstates and get that for that particular band. So this one really tell us which band we occupy. Okay. And the other will be same as before. We have a wave packet, we have plane wave, but we have this additional thing. So this additional thing is really like the internal degree freedom. You know, if you're changing k, this one have a k dependence. So therefore, each side would enter with different amplitude as you're changing k. You can really see from here. Yeah. Okay. So let's just do it. And so I will, because time, I will do a simpler calculation than the lecture notes. And the calculation is actually is pretty straightforward. It's really just repeat what we just did. Okay. And so. So we have this, and I ddt. So this is a Fourier phase term. So then we also have this Hamiltonian. OK, let me calculate the easy thing first. And this one actually is a epsilon k plus phi x. OK. Again, here I add some potential term on each side. So I add some potential term on each side. So we have a potential phi. And this calculation is exactly as before. Oh, yeah, epsilon r phi, yes. Exactly as before. OK, this is a vector. Because to calculate this average Hamiltonian for the hopping term, we assume c is very big. So we just drop this using the plane wave. Then we get just eigenvalue. When you're calculating the average for the potential term, we assume c is not so big, and potential is almost constant. So therefore, the total contribution is just a potential term at the center mass. So this just as before. And the Fourier phase term is different. OK. So in the Fourier phase term, so when we do the calculation, we want to do the, we can, for example, we can make a derivative respect to k. If you make derivative respect to k, we bring down an I. When you bring down an I, then average of I gave us center mass. So that's how it gave us a minus k. Sorry, give us a minus x k dot. So this is the same as before. But however, here we have actual contribution. When you're making derivative respect to k, in the previous case, this is the only k dependence. They just bring down I. But now we have another k dependence from here. So there's an actual contribution from here. So what is this actual contribution? This actual contribution actually is given by this. So let me just write it down. This actual contribution is given by is plus c k dot k dot. So there's an actual contribution from the k. What is c k? So let me just give the expression, then I explain it. C I. Is function of k. It's given by this psi alpha dagger k partial k psi alpha k. So here this psi alpha k is really a column vector. So psi alpha 1 is function of k, psi alpha 2 is function of k, and etc. So this is a column vector which have a k dependence, basically. And so when you're making derivative to the column vector, we get another column vector. And this column vector have overlap with the previous column vector. Then we get some number. Oh, there's an I here. Let me see whether we have I or minus I. Yes? Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So let me just try to get this the formula. Let me see, where is it? Yeah. So there's I here. I put I here. So there's I here. Yes?
Non-degenerate.
Yeah. So just like picture the band non-degenerate. Yeah. Suddenly when band touch this additional complexity, we don't talk about that. Okay. Yeah. So this is how C is defined. Okay. Maybe let me do some vector. So this is the vector derivative. So this is the vector. Okay. So how we get this? And again, it's a little puzzling. You know how you get these results? Well, it's pretty messy here. Okay. But one way to look at this result, to see the result is following, to notice that this part is the orbital part. This part is the internal degree freedom part. There's two parts, and they are tensor product. So what we did is to consider these two parts separately. That is, this term actually coming from orbital part, and this part is dropped. But because the internal degree part also have a k dependence, so we have this confusion from this internal degree freedom part as well. But in this case, the orbital part is dropped. So that's why the contribution from this internal degree freedom is purely written in terms of internal degree freedom is column vector. No orbital contribution. Yeah. So this is the best way to see this. You don't need to worry about the orbital part, just directly write this down. But if you don't believe this, if you don't believe what you see, you can really do the calculation. And it's a messy calculation, but you'll get same results. Yeah. Okay. And certainly there's another contribution, which is like you make a derivative respect to x. And x also have a time dependence. But however, due to the same reason, you make a derivative respect to x, you bring down something I minus x, which is odd respect to x, and this average is 0. So actually the coefficient here is 0. So there's nothing from x. Okay. So finally, we obtain the phase space Lagrangian for the motion of a particle inside a crystal or semiconductor. So let me just using this k x dot. Again, we kind of replace this as a k x dot up to a total derivative term of something. Okay, and then we have this actual contribution is a really minus a plus c dot k dot, and then we have this the euro term . This is the average energy of the wave packet. It's a kinetic energy plus potential energy basically. Okay, so what is the equation motion looks like? So once we have this, okay, let me just do one more thing. Okay, or maybe here I don't need to do one more thing. Okay, yeah. Then once we do this, we get this equation motion. Let me say ki dot equal to minus partial phi, partial xi, and xi dot equal to partial epsilon partial ki. So this is the equation motion we get. And this is a new term, where this d is given by this dij is a function of k, which is a partial epsilon, a partial cj partial ki minus partial ci partial kj. So basically, if you treat k as a x and treat c as a vector potential, then this is like a field strength, magnitude field strength. So the c behave like a vector potential in the k space, and the d is a magnetic field strength in k space. It's a new kind of magnetic field in k space. So that's it. We have this. And the things can be more symmetric if we can write down this. We can even write down like a dij x dot j if you want. So because I did not include the vector potential in real space, if you include vector potential in real space, we will have this term, this Lorentz force term, the magnetic field will have a speed dependent force. And so this is very symmetric. And in the notes, I derived this term, but here I did not derive this term. So let's just drop this term. But this term really like the magnetic field in the K space. And so the key point is that the velocity is no longer equal to partial epsilon partial K. Velocity have actual correction. They have an extra correction. And this extra correction can be also written as a force. You can see the k dot is a force. So this is a force. This space is a force. So velocity have a force dependence. It's very interesting. There's a force dependence on the velocity. OK. So this is this gave us a new kind of dynamics. And then you say, so what? You know, yeah, you have a different equation motion. A Newton's law is modified. So what? Well, this is in physics, that's when you have a new effect, you ask, how do I detect this new effect? How do I observe the effect? That means, what experiments do you do to observe this phenomena? If this is new phenomena, you want to see that. But to see that, you need to design experiments. So it's very important for the theory student to learn how to design experiments, although you'll never do it. But actually, it's fun. You design experiments. Hope somebody will do it, follow your design. So maybe that's a question for you. Is that we have this thing, you know, how do I design experiments to see this? Okay. So actually, in the next class, we'll discuss this. You know, what is the consequence of these new terms? It turns out that this term can give rise to so-called anomalous Hall effect. You know, usually the Hall effect is that when you have a magnetic field, then the electric field in one direction would induce current in the transverse direction. That's kind of Hall effect, which is present in the magnetic field. But however, with this term, we will see that even without magnetic field in a semiconductor, by applying electric field in one direction, you may get currents in the cross direction, in the transverse direction. And this term have that effect. So one can using that to study this anomalous Hall effect. Okay, I will stop here. So next class we will talk about that and some topology of a band.